this is Greg Vandermeer. I'm the lead pastor at Fairhaven Church. Welcome to our weekly podcast. Fairhaven is part of Harbor Churches, a multi-site church located in West Michigan. We exist to help people find their way back to God. We hope this message helps you take your next step in your faith journey. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Fairhaven. My name's Jeremy. Excited to be here with you this morning. And just to start off, some of you realize something's different in the room this morning, right? So to address the elephant or the TV in the room, why have a TV on the stage this morning? Well, couple reasons. One, we're on week two of the series that we're in on the book of Exodus. So we have a lot of ground to cover today. And I know the Lions kick off already like tomorrow night at 8:15. So like just in case we're still working through it, right? No, why the TV on the stage? Partly because we here at Fairhaven, one of the things that we value is diving deeply into the words of the scriptures. And we believe that the Bible is as relevant and real and life-giving as ever. And so we're constantly trying to ask the question, how can we use the abilities we have and the technology we have to continue to open the stories in ways that help us see that it's not just their story a long time ago, but it's also our story that God is continuing to work out as he's advancing his kingdom still here today. And so one of the ways we're doing that is through utilizing a TV to help with our live stream. My hope is we'll find value here in the space. But like I said, this morning, we're going to be diving back into the book of Exodus. That if you're newer with us, one of the things that we will often do is we'll take a book of the Bible. We started a couple years ago, we did the book of Matthew. About a year ago, we dove into the book of Genesis. Now we're diving into the book of Exodus, where occasionally we'll kind of stand up here and we'll do sermon series, or we'll kind of jump around the scriptures and look at different stories from different places. And then at times we'll take a book. We'll take a story and we'll dive deep into that story, and we'll essentially follow that story where that story brings us. And so this morning we are on week two of a 40-week series. 40 is a very biblical, very Exodus number. Second week of 40 weeks working through that book of Exodus. And so if you want to follow along today, we will be in Exodus chapter 1. We do have a lot to cover today. We'll be kind of Exodus 1 and we'll jump into Exodus chapter 2. But before we really dive into the story, I want to start by kind of reminding us of something that Pastor Greg shared with us last week about how through the book of Genesis, so if the book of Exodus is the second book in the Bible, we start with the book of Genesis. The book of Genesis largely kind of is framed by these three promises that God gives to his people. That all the way back, God calls a person in Abraham to himself. God says, I will be your God, you will be my people. God will essentially give three promises to Abraham. And so if we look at the three promises, the first promise God gives is a promise of family, where God tells Abraham, I will be your God, I will make your family increase so that your descendants will outnumber, he says, the stars in the sky, the sand on the seashore. God says, I will give you descendants. First promise God gives is family. Second promise God gives is land. Not only will you be a people, but you will be a people that have a place. God promises a land. God promises a land. It's why we call it the promised land. That God says you'll have descendants. You will have a place to call your own. And then the third one is one that we often kind of overlook, but it's influence. That God says you'll have family. You'll have a land. And then God gives kind of the why. Well, God says through you, all people everywhere will be blessed. God says, you will so have influence in your world that because of who you are, because of how you live, all people will eventually be able to come to know me. There's family, land, and influence. But then kind of behind the surface in the book of Genesis, into the book of Exodus, it feels like there's this question that kind of lingers. And that question is this. It's, is God going to make good on his promises? Maybe the question behind it is, can God make good on his promises? But for sure, a question that kind of lingers behind the stories is God going to make good on the promises he made to his people? And we see it right from the start. Because when God calls Abraham, God says, I will give you descendants. Let's just look at the first promise, that promise of family. God says, your descendants will outnumber the stars in the sky and the sand in the sea, except there's a problem that we read that when God gives the promise, Abraham and Sarah, we're told, they're already 100 years old. They're too old, we're told, to have kids, but it doesn't even need to tell us that, right? They're 100 years old. How is God going to make good? How is God going to make good? And then what we find is, sure enough, God blesses Abraham and his wife Sarah, blesses them with a child, this son by the name of Isaac. And so he gives them a kid. Now, a kid is way short of the stars of the sky, but at least there's a chance now, right? And then we find that son, Isaac, he grows up. He gets married to a woman by the name of Rebecca. And the first thing we're told when he marries Rebecca, the first thing we're told about Rebecca is she cannot have children. So we're forced back into the question, is God going to make good? Is God going to follow through? Sure enough, again, we see God blesses up Isaac and Rebekah with kids. And this time we read it's not just one, but they become pregnant with twins. So we're, first family has a child, second family then has two. So like it's slow going, but we're kind of moving forward, right? And then you find out that those two sons hate each other, that the one vows to kill the other, and so the one has to flee and run from home. And the whole time we're asking the question, is God going to make good? Through the book of Genesis, if God promises people, God promises descendants, through the book of Genesis, we essentially have a person and their immediate family. We have Abraham and his family. Then we have their son Isaac and his family, and then we'll follow to Jacob and Jacob's family, and the book of Genesis ends with Joseph. Again, just a person. We're promised many. We're promised sand of the seashore, stars of the sky. We essentially are moving forward in ones. Is God going to make good? And then there's the second promise. So the first one is family. Second promise is land. And to explain this one, I want to show us a map. So we're a little bit more zoomed out on the map than what we normally look at. Normally, when we pull up a map, we're only looking at the nation of Israel, which is right here. We'll kind of reference the Sea of Galilee and the Dead Sea. But right now, if we zoom out, when God first calls Abraham, when God says, leave your family, your land, and your people, we know when God calls Abraham, Abraham's living right around here. He's in the land of Ur, and God will call him. God will say, I have a land for you. Leave your land and travel to the place I will show you. So Abraham's going to leave Ur right around here, and he's going to make his way to the promised land. At the time, this was considered the land of Canaan. So he's moving from here to here. For us, we kind of live in the world of like planes, trains, and automobiles, right? So if we know we're going to move from the right side of the map to the left side, it's easy for us to think, well, how do you get there? Well, you just travel in a straight line, right? You would leave Ur and you'd travel straight across to this promised land. But do you notice the color through here? It's largely brown. It's kind of orangish. It's tan. It's brown. It's straight up desert. If we were to drop in this area, kind of the area of Wadi Rum, it's going to look similar to this. It looks kind of alien, doesn't it? It looks otherworldly, which is maybe why there have been a couple kind of recent films that were actually shot in this desert. One of them, the Dune movies, were shot in that desert, maybe a more popular movie. If you saw The Martian with Matt Damon, it literally looks like another world. That is that desert that lies in between. And so if you're Abraham and Abraham's family, and you're going to leave Ur and travel to the promised land, the last thing you do is travel hundreds of miles through a place that looks like Mars, right? So what do you do? This thing is pretty. I can actually color on it. Let's pull that up. All right, here we go. and the menu bar pops up, maybe. All right, okay, there we go. Okay, and I'm gonna change the color. So if Abraham is starting right here, do you see that on the map? It doesn't show up on the back screen, but if Abraham's starting here and he's going to end up, this is the land that God promised, the last thing he's gonna do is travel hundreds of miles across desert. So what do you do? Well, you follow a way that can support life. You're essentially gonna follow water. Do you see right here? This is the region of it's the Tigris and the Euphrates. We actually call this the Fertile Crescent because it has access to water. So what Abraham's gonna do is he's gonna follow up here. We know they're gonna stop right up in this direction because they're gonna stop in the city of Haran, which is right up here. And then Abraham's dad is gonna die. He's gonna come down. And the book of Genesis, for a chunk of the book of Genesis, they are kind of wandering around in this land that God had promised. They really haven't settled. They really don't own property. It's really not quite home yet, but they're kind of there. But then late in the book of Genesis, we read something happens, that a famine strikes the land. This famine makes it so they're wondering how they're gonna live. There is no food, there is no water, there's no way to grow. And so near the end of the book of Genesis, the family is wondering, if God has promised descendants, how are we even gonna live through what we're living through? And so they, like so many people in their world, they go to a place looking for survival, for life. Do you notice on the map? So there's a lot of brown, there's a lot of tan. Do you notice there's a little chunk of dark green? It's right here. What this is it's essentially the Nile River Delta. So the Nile River is going to spill into the Mediterranean, and this is going to be in the midst of a famine, this is still gonna be fertile. This is still land you can live on. And so what happens is the Israelite people, they're gonna leave the land God promised, and they're gonna find themselves at the end of Genesis entering this other land, this good land. They can live on land, but it's not the land God promised. But do you notice on the map how quickly it goes from brown to green? If we actually jumped on the ground there, if we go to that next picture, oh, I gotta change this. Do you notice how you've got the Nile River, you have green, you have vegetation, you have fertile land, and then right behind it, you have desert and you have rock and you have nothing. This is how big a difference the Nile River makes. So we have a people in the midst of a famine, wondering how are we going to live? How are we gonna make it? How are we gonna survive? They go where you go in a famine. They go to a place that produces life. They find their way down to Egypt. And it feels like at the back of the story, it's continuing to ask that question, is God going to make good? Is God going to give descendants? Is God going to give the sand of the seashore and the stars in the sky? They're in a land. They're in a land that they can live off, but it's not the land God promised. And so what is God going to do? Is God going to make good? And then we launch into the book of Exodus. So Exodus 1, we're going to start at verse 6. It says, now Joseph and all his brothers and all that generation died. But the Israelites were exceedingly fruitful. They multiplied greatly. They increased in numbers and became so numerous that the land was filled with them. So the book of Exodus starts by essentially trying to answer that first promise, right? The question of that first promise around family. Is God giving descendants? Yes, for the very first time in the story, we have more than a person in their immediate family. Now they are so numerous that the land is filled with them. But it feels like the author of Exodus is actually setting us up for what comes next. So if we jump to the next, then a new king to whom Joseph meant nothing came to power in Egypt. Look, he said to his people, the Israelite people have become far too numerous for us. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous. And then watch how paranoid the Pharaoh gets here. The Pharaoh will start to speculate. You can see this, like, this threat to power, this paranoia. He says, if war breaks out, they might join our enemies, they might fight against us, and then they might leave the country. So the Pharaoh sees this growing group of people. The Pharaoh sees them as threat to his power, to his empire, and the Pharaoh decides something must happen. So just in that first moment where it feels like God is making good, like we have a people, immediately says they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor. They built Pithom and Ramses as store cities for Pharaoh. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. It feels like the story is continuing to move forward. So the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites and worked them ruthlessly. They made their lives bitter with harsh labor in brick and mortar and with all kinds of work in the fields. In all their harsh labor, the Egyptians worked them ruthlessly. So the story pivots really quickly, right in that moment where it feels like God is giving family. We have descendants, we've got numbers. Immediately things change. That immediately, in a blink of an eye, things go from what was to what is. They go from this land being a land where they can survive in the midst of famine to being the very land that they are being oppressed, they are being enslaved in, that in the blink of an eye, everything changed. There's what was, and now there's what is. And this is where I think many of us, we know what this feels like, right? To move from what was to what is, those moments where in our lives where all of a sudden everything changed, where nothing's the same. For some of us, for you, maybe this, you worked in the same company for 20 years, right? The same desk, the same office, and you'd had thoughts that maybe this is where you retire. You're going to spend the rest of your career here, and then one morning you get a memo that the company is sold, there's new leadership, and what you find is you walk into that same desk at that same office, and you realize nothing's the same, that everything's changed, and now you find yourself asking, what am I going to do? Right? Am I going to stick this out? What am I going to do? What do I do now? How do I respond when everything's changed? For some of us, it's that moment when things were going well, right? Like you were ticking the to-dos off from your to-do list. You were kind of going through the calendar. One event goes into the next, and life was going well. It was normal. And then one morning you found that bump. Right? Or the test came back and somebody said, okay, we need to talk. And all of a sudden you found that everything changed. There's what was, and all of a sudden you're thrown into what is. And you find that, like, if you or a close family member, a close friend has ever been there, you realize how quickly things change when all of a sudden you realize it's only been a few weeks. And like your whole vocabulary is shifted, and now you know words you didn't even know existed before. And you're having conversations. And if you would have asked 3 weeks ago, you'd have no idea what you're talking about. But all of a sudden, everything has changed. There's what you thought was going to happen, and then the person said they're no longer going to stay. They're going to be out. And all of a sudden, you realize that everything has changed. So how do we respond? How did they respond? How do we respond when we're in those spaces in life where everything's changed? Because I think the question they asked is often the question that we still ask when we're in these spaces. It's that same question. Is God going to make good on his promises? Right? These first Israelites who are in this land, who are now being enslaved in the very land where they found life or they found sustenance, are now asking God, where are you? God, why is this happening? God, what are you going to do about it? That often when we find ourselves in those spaces, we ask those same questions, don't we? Like, God, where are you? God, why is this happening? God, what are you going to do? God, what do I do? So how do we respond, and how did they respond? See, I want to look at the story today. And what I want to do is I want to pull out at the end of it a few kind of examples of how the Israelite people first responded in their moment when everything had changed. Let's jump back in. It says, so the king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, whose names were Shiphrah and Puah, when you are helping the Hebrew women during childbirth on the delivery stool, if you see that the baby is a boy, kill him. But if it's a girl, let her live. Now, I want to give you a picture of this. So the Egyptians would have used what is called a delivery stool. It looks like this. And so when a pregnant mother was giving birth, you would have a couple of midwives, usually would stand kind of on either side to help hold arms, and then one to catch the baby as it was born. And so the Pharaoh says, when the Hebrew women are giving birth, if it's a girl, sure, let her live. If it's a boy, kill it on the spot. Pharaoh is paranoid. Pharaoh now wants to restrict the growth of this people. We read the midwives' response. It says, the midwives, however, feared God and did not do what the king of Egypt had told them to do. They let the boys live. A question. In the story, how much power do the midwives have? In ancient Egypt, how much power do the midwives have? None, right? None. They're midwives. How much power does Pharaoh have? All of it. All of it. So the midwives, even in their lack of power, even in their lack to do anything to change Pharaoh's decrees, what I love about the midwives' response is the midwives said, even in the face of what Pharaoh ordered, we are going to continue to do the right thing simply because it's the right thing, regardless of what it might mean for us. Right? These midwives feared God more than they feared this edict, this decree from the Pharaoh. And so they said, regardless, whatever consequences might come, whatever Pharaoh might do to us, we are going to continue to fear God, to be faithful, to do the right thing simply because they are the right things. God saw this. God will bless the midwives. The next says, the king of Egypt summoned the midwives, asked them, why have you done this? Why have you let the boys live? The midwives answered Pharaoh, Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women. They're vigorous and give birth before the midwives arrive. So they come up with this story that like it happens so fast. Like we show up and the baby's already born. And like, so they try to give this explanation to the Pharaoh. The Pharaoh doesn't like this explanation. It'll go on. God will bless the midwives and the Pharaoh will respond. And the next one says, so God was kind to the midwives, and the people increased and became even more numerous. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families of their own. Then Pharaoh gave this order to all of his people. Every Hebrew boy that is born, you must throw into the Nile, but let every girl live. So Pharaoh, he has that question with the midwives. He gives that decree first to the midwives, kill every baby boy. He finds out the midwives aren't doing it. They come, they give their little explanation. And now Pharaoh is so determined to restrict the growth of this people, of the Israelite people, that he goes around the midwives and now he just makes a decree to all of Egypt, right? Any Hebrew boy must be killed. And then we turn to Exodus chapter 2 and we read about the birth of a really special baby boy that we'll be following literally for the next 38 weeks. It says, now a man of the tribe of Levi married a Levite woman, and she became pregnant and gave birth to a son. When she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him for 3 months. But when she could hide him no longer, she got a papyrus basket for him, coated it with tar and pitch. Then she placed the child in it and put it among the reeds along the bank of the Nile. His sister stood at a distance to see what would happen to him. Then Pharaoh's daughter went down to the Nile to bathe, and her attendants were walking along the riverbank. When she saw the basket among the reeds and sent her female slave to get it, she opened it and saw the baby. He was crying and she felt sorry for him. This is one of the Hebrew babies, she said. Then his sister asked Pharaoh's daughter, shall I go and get one of the Hebrew women to nurse the baby for you? Yes, go, she answered. So the girl went and got the baby's mother. Pharaoh's daughter said to her, take this baby and nurse him for me, and I will pay you. So the woman took the baby and nursed him. When the child grew older, she took him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. So she named him Moses, saying, I drew him out of the water. Now, this section ends with the naming of Moses. That name is going to be important. We will jump into the story of Moses and how his name matters. We'll jump into that in a few weeks, and so that will come. But what I want to kind of draw to the story this morning is the response of a few groups of people. And first, I want to ask the question, in the story, were we ever given Pharaoh's name? Because Pharaoh is essentially a title. Pharaoh is similar to like president or king. He's the leader of Egypt. Are we ever given his name? One of my favorite things about the book of Exodus is the Pharaoh's name is never given. He's simply the Pharaoh. And Pharaoh, if you actually translate it, Pharaoh means great house or big house, right? Go blue. Please donate candy, please. But Pharaoh, essentially, the book of Exodus, we'll talk about Pharaoh, is like, he's just the guy who lives in the big house, right? He's the guy who thinks he's in charge, but just follow the story because you'll realize Pharaoh is actually not in charge. Pharaoh's just a guy who gets to live in a big house. Pharaoh's never named. But did you notice in the story who was named? The first two people who are named in our story are maybe your favorite characters in the book of Exodus, right? Shifra and Puah. These two, we're told, were the two midwives who first stood up against the decree of Pharaoh. These people are named, and yet Pharaoh never is. So rabbis over history have asked the question, like, who are these people? Why are they named? And They've come up with a number of options. One option that some people have come up with is, well, maybe Shifra and Puah, they say, are maybe it's a different name given to actually like Moses' mom and sister. We'll know later on that Moses' mom's name is Jochebed, his sister is Miriam, but if you translate it, Shifra means beautiful, which would be a nice thing to say, and Puah means little girl. So they say, well, maybe it's them. But the story never tells us that. And then others think, well, maybe Shifra and Puah aren't actually Hebrew. Maybe they're Egyptian midwives. And the thing they'll point to for that is in the Exodus, when it says that they were Hebrew midwives, that phrase in the Hebrew could just as easily be translated as midwives over the Hebrews. And so they say, well, maybe they're Egyptians because the Pharaoh first gives them the command to kill all of the Hebrew boys. Like, would it make sense that a Hebrew midwife would kill their own people? So maybe they're Egyptians, and the fact that the Pharaoh doesn't kill them when he finds out they're not doing it. So maybe they're Egyptians. And then the bulk of scholarship just says, well, maybe they're simply two midwives who just did what they could with what they had ability over to be faithful to do what was right simply because it was right. Maybe they were simply midwives who chose to follow the way of God in the face of the way of Pharaoh. Now, what I love about these two is I imagine if like we figured out how to make a time machine, right? So like somebody makes this time machine. If we could dial it back and go 4,000 years ago and stand in front of Shifra and Puah, my guess is if we showed up, we found them, hey, it's so great to meet you. Like, did you know that in 4,000 years, people are still going to tell the stories of what you've done? That we caught Shifra and Puah and said, like, in 4,000, like, what you're doing, God is working through you to do something. You're actually setting the stage for what God is going to do to set his people free, even from their slavery in Egypt. My guess is Shifra and Puah are going to push against you going, what are you talking about? I can't do anything in the face of Pharaoh. I can't do anything in the face of Egypt and the slavery and all of the things that they're doing. All we're doing is trying to be faithful to do the right thing in helping these baby boys live. If I could summarize this chunk of the book of Exodus, like if I could give like a thesis, like a summary, I think it'd be this, that God does extraordinary things through extraordinary people. People just like you and me, people like Shifra and Puah, who in this in the scope of all that is that Pharaoh is doing, that the Egyptians are doing, they can't change it. But what they can do is they can do what they're able to do, even if it's a, even if it feels like a small thing in the scope of the bigness of what's happening. And in that, God is able to use what they're doing to advance the story forward. First is Shifra and Pua. The second one, she's not named in the story. She'll get named later. But Miriam is Moses' sister, the one that's hiding in the reeds. My guess is if that time machine, right, if it brings us and we find Miriam hiding in the reeds and we say, Miriam, it's so great. Like, what you're doing right now is actually going to save the life of the very one who's going to lead the Israelite people, the Hebrew people, out of slavery. What you're doing is so instrumental in the movement of God to set his people free. This happens because of you. My guess is Miriam would do something like Shifra and Pua and say, what do you mean? I can't do anything in the face of the Pharaoh. All I'm trying to do is make sure that my baby brother stays safe. Right? In the scope of the bigness of what she's facing, she can't change that. But what she can do is she can make sure that her baby brother stays safe. And so she does the right thing because it's the right thing. And again, what God does is God does something extraordinary through the acts of a really normal, ordinary person just like you and me. And see, I think often, especially in those spots where it feels like everything changes, when we're in those spaces in life, it feels like we often look at the bigness of what's happening. And I wonder if one of the things the book of Exodus teaches us is, sure, pray that God would change the big things, the large circumstances, absolutely yes. And that we wouldn't turn a blind eye, that we wouldn't forget about the small things that we're actually able to do in the midst of that can actually make a significant difference. As I was thinking about this morning, there were a handful of stories that kind of jumped out to me that I was thinking about times when people did something that might feel really small that made a big difference. And I couldn't help but think of one of the more recent times when it feels like everything in our world changed, where there was what was and then there's what is. And unless you've blocked the entire year out of your memory, anybody remember 2020? Right, like there's what was and then there's what is. And I'll never forget a story of what a family that actually calls Fairhaven home, one of the ways they responded in the midst of all of the change. It's a story of Chris and Jill Longstreet. I called Jill this week and asked if I could share the story. If you knew Chris and Jill, they absolute gift. Chris unfortunately passed away in 2022, just a couple years ago. But if you knew Chris worked in the hospitality industry, but hospitality wasn't a job for him. It was who he was. It was who they were, that they so often gave themselves to making people feel welcomed and loved and cared for. And in the midst of all of the things of 2020, what they realized is they couldn't do anything to change the circumstances around them, right? They couldn't do that. But what they did is they started asking the question, how can we do even small things that we're able to do to make sure that people feel loved, that they feel cared for, how can we even do that in the midst? And so what they realized is they kind of had a routine that every Sunday night, they would make the same meal for their family every Sunday night. It was chicken wings. And if you'd ever had their chicken wings, you know why they ate them every Sunday night. They're amazing. But what they started doing is on Sundays, they would every week, they would call a different family that they were somewhat connected to and just ask, hey, on Sunday, my family, we do chicken wings. Before we have ours, can we make a whole meal like what we're gonna have later, but can we make it and then just drop it off for you so you can have that and then we'll go home and make ours for ourselves. There was one week we got to be the recipients of the wings. And so that day they started early, they made the wings, they dropped them off that Sunday just as a way of letting us know that, hey, we're thinking about you guys, caring about you, love you guys. Did it change the bigness of that year? No. But did it change things for us in that year? Yeah. For sure. It changed some of the way I view what it means to live on mission, to be good news to people around me, to use what I do and the things that I have ability and control over to be a blessing to all the people around me. Absolutely, yes. Because God continues to do great things through ordinary people doing what they can to make a difference. It's all the stories. I have too many of these to even name one, but it's all the stories I've had of people that I've been able to walk alongside over the years who have just gotten a really hard diagnosis, right? The really hard ones where you're told that it might be days or weeks or months. And what so often the stories I've been able to walk alongside are people who, yes, they were going to give themselves to all of the treatments to try to extend those days, but they realized in the midst of it that they, so much of that was out of their control, that it was almost out of their control to add days. But what they could do is they could change the way they lived the days that they had. And all of the stories that I've had where I've been able to walk alongside people who have become more intentional, who became closer to their family, their friends, the people around them, for people who fundamentally decided that they were going to live the days they had different. And the impact that had on the people around them and the world around them, because I fundamentally believe that what God did in the Exodus, God continues to do, that God will continue to do extraordinary things through ordinary people like you and me who do what we can to make a difference to further God's kingdom here. It's what we see in the New Testament when Jesus will call his disciples. And what he does is Jesus doesn't call the best of the best. Jesus calls a whole bunch of ordinary fishermen and tax collectors and zealots and a whole bunch of normal, common, ordinary, everyday people and says, if you simply do what you can, if you simply say yes to the mission, to joining me in what I'm doing in the world will never be the same. So I wonder, as we launch into the book of Exodus, before we get to the big names of Moses and him standing before the Pharaoh, if we start by just asking the question, if this is what God did, if this is what God does, how might God still be wanting to do that through each and every one of us, through you, through me, by simply doing the right things because it's the right things, by following the way of God, by doing what we can in small ways, in big ways, to advance his kingdom here? I believe we'll continue to see God do unbelievable things in our world like he did in theirs. Would you pray with me? God, for your scriptures, God, we are grateful for these stories and how these stories ring true across generations and across time and space. God, for the way you call us to respond in the same way that you called them, to be faithful, to live our lives on mission, to do what we can with what we have control over, whether big or small, to give ourselves to partnering in what you're doing in this, your world. That anytime we want to try to count ourselves out because we're just whatever, however we would fill that, we would finish that sentence. God, that we would realize that you are calling us to be a piece of a much larger thing of what you are doing here, and that all you've called us to do is to be faithful, to follow after you, and to show those around us who you are and how we live. God, we pray that you would continue to use us, to work through us, to continue to advance your kingdom here. It's in Jesus' name, amen.
Thank you for listening. Our hope is that you were able to catch a glimpse of Jesus as seen in the scripture, and it'll help you as you live a life modeled after his. For service times or for more information about how to be a part of Fairhaven, you can visit us at fhchurch.org. Have a great week.